This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting WLRN Public Radio in Miami. Diplomacy often makes or breaks a democracy. America won independence from Britain with help from France. France drove back the Nazis with help from the U.S. and Britain. But those military victories hinged on alliances forged by diplomacy. So why don't diplomats get treated like rock stars? Why is it that no one throws diplomats a parade? And how is it that the halls of the U.S. State Department are largely empty these days, with few new hires and many career staff losing jobs? Ronan Farrow wants answers to these questions. The investigative journalist just won a Pulitzer, along with Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey of the New York Times, for his reporting on Harvey Weinstein and sexual assault in the entertainment industry. But Farrow's new book is about a different system altogether, a system that's suffering less from corruption than corrosion. Dismantled from the inside out.
It's time for the Pop Culture Happy Hour Summer Movie Preview. We're predicting hits and flops, telling you what we're looking forward to, and helping you spend that ticket money wisely. Available right now from Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Joining us from NPR in New York is Ronan Farrow, a contributing writer for The New Yorker. His new book is called War on Peace: The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence. Ronan, congrats on the Pulitzer and welcome to 1A.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Joshua.
You joined the State Department at 16 years old. What were you hoping to get out of working for the State Department?
That's not quite accurate. It was a few years after that. I did start doing work with Richard Holbrooke, who was one of the last great larger-than-life diplomats and whose story is one of the lenses through which I view the corrosion you talk about at that very early age. And then I came back to work for him as he tried to make peace in Afghanistan and died doing so. And that was several years later. I would have been around 20 at the time.
What were you hoping to gain from your work at the State Department? What drew you to it?
You know, I had had those earlier experiences working with Richard Holbrooke. He had been a UN official, obviously, U.S. ambassador to the UN, rather. He had worked as an advisor on the Kerry campaign. And so partly it was through sheer dint of the whirlwind of his personality. You know, this book, War on Peace, as you said, is about a vast trend, a real transformation in the way America relates to the world, that we are becoming a nation devoid of peacemakers and negotiators that shoots first and asks questions much later or not at all. But I tell it through the lens of these very personal stories, including one that I was wrapped up in myself, which was the decline of Richard Holbrooke. And one of the things I talk about is that he just, in the words of Henry Kissinger, didn't take no for an answer. And when he went about recruiting this sort of Ocean's 11-style heist team to try to end the war in Afghanistan, it was very hard to resist that call. I was just coming out of law school, and I was a wet behind the ears, if anything, foreign policy expert on Africa, and yet he wanted outsiders. He wanted voices that could defy the conventions of the system. And I think the State Department for sure needs that. It needs reform. But right now, we're not reforming. We're throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
I wonder how this book came about. It's not like you've not been busy for the last few years writing about Harvey Weinstein and Rose McGowan and the Me Too movement and payoffs to keep scandalous stories about the president under wraps. What brought this book about in the midst of everything else?
So this book was very personal for me, Joshua. I came about it and my sort of passion for the subject because I was living in the midst of this trend. Already in Afghanistan during the first term of the Obama administration, what you saw was an Afghan review process overtaken by celebrity generals. And there are senior Obama administration officials in this book, War on Peace, who are extraordinarily frank, people like Ben Rhodes saying, yeah, you know what, we made a mistake and we tried to correct course and veer away from that celebrity general culture in the second term. But during that first term, You know, I saw Richard Holbrooke frozen out of that process. A lot of that was politics. It was personality driven. He was an imperfect guy. But there was also a systemic problem. And I reveal in this book for the first time a lot of his last anguished memos to Hillary Clinton, where he decried a policy process overtaken by what he called milthink, you know, military thinking. And, you know, the military will always push for escalation. And we're seeing yet another escalation in Afghanistan right now. I don't think anybody thinks that diplomats like Richard Holbrooke could have waltzed into Afghanistan and fixed the thing. It's one of the most intractable situations in the world. But what the experts seem to agree on is this is one of many conflicts where we surrendered a window where we had maximum influence because of our military presence there. A window in which we could have reached at least some inroads towards a political settlement. And opportunities for that were actively sabotaged. That is the trend that I document around the world in War on Peace, and it's one I saw very painfully firsthand.
Ronan, I definitely want to talk about your Harvey Weinstein reporting and your reporting that's had such a strong effect on the Me Too movement. Before we shift that gear, though, you said you spoke to every living Secretary of State for this book. What were those conversations like? Were they reticent to talk? Were they eager to talk?
You know, I am grateful to say, one after another, with probably only one exception, they were eager to talk and really transparent. And, you know, that didn't change along party lines. People like Colin Powell were incredibly candid. I think Powell in particular is as candid as I've ever seen him on the record. And, you know, he was one of many secretaries who sounded, frankly, anguished on this subject, who cared deeply about and invested deeply in the workforce at the State Department and said of the current situation there, this purge, these mass firings that I talk about, we are ripping the guts out of the State Department. That was his phrase. And he said, this is essentially mortgaging our future. So you'll find points of unexpected candor from, I think, everyone, including Rex Tillerson, who gives one of his last and most frank interviews about the White House's machinations to oust him.
I do want to talk more about Rex Tillerson as we go ahead, but for people who've never been to the State Department, who don't know what the State Department is like, can you just paint us a picture of what I'd notice if I walked into the State Department at Foggy Bottom in Washington, D.C. today? What would stand out to me?
You know, in the lobby at the Foggy Bottom headquarters of the State Department, I'll focus on one particular thing that always stood out to me working there, which is engraved in marble on the walls at either side of the lobby are the names of fallen diplomats. And the reality is these are men and women who bravely defend the United States. And they do so very often in the most dangerous places on earth. They do so at great cost to their family lives, at the expense of career opportunities in the private sector. And what they do is really important. And that's the simple day-to-day mechanics of, you know, getting Americans out of dangerous situations and, you know, what they call consular work of making sure our country is protected and vetting people who come into it. But also at the highest level, in every crisis, we need the tool of first resort to be cutting a deal, making peace. And that's not to say that that's always the way out, that military escalation is never the answer. But it is certainly the case that we don't want to go to military escalation first. And we're being cornered into a situation where that's the only tool we have.
Last October, the New York Times broke an explosive story.
The New York Times alleges that Harvey Weinstein is guilty of decades of sexual harassment. This in an expose just published hours ago.
5 days later, The New Yorker took it further.
What started as a trickle of allegations against movie mogul Harvey Weinstein has now become a flood. The New Yorker magazine says the accusations now include rape.
That set off a tidal wave of changes across industries, including in entertainment.
A civil lawsuit has been filed accusing Oscar-winning filmmaker Paul Haggis of rape.
The growing backlash for Kevin Spacey amid that sexual misconduct accusation.
News this morning about the comedian Louis C.K., who has come out to say that the accusations against him are in fact true.
And in broadcasting.
NBC News today fired Today Show anchor Matt Lauer.
Longtime radio host Garrison Keillor has been fired.
You know, Charlie Rose is the host of PBS's Charlie Rose Show, but today he is also the latest high-profile man to face sexual harassment allegations.
And in politics.
U.S. Senator Al Franken.
Texas Republican Blake Fahrenholt.
Now the latest on embattled Senate candidate Roy Moore.
It's quite a cascade of events that's dramatically elevated the Me Too movement, emboldening more women to demand accountability after suffering sexual harassment, assault, rape, and or misconduct. Ronan, how do you reflect on the impact of your reporting? I'm sure that you were honored to receive the Pulitzer, but I wonder just when you think about the scope of what has been unleashed in the last year with all this reporting, what goes through your head, what goes through your heart when you reflect on this?
Gratitude and, frankly, relief. These were incredibly brave sources that came forward. It's easy to forget because the world really has changed in some very significant ways in the last few months on this issue. But at the time, this was a lose-lose proposition in the eyes of a lot of these women who were struggling with whether to come forward. It was speaking about an issue that they felt they would never be heard on. It was the prospect of career annihilation. It was the prospect of physical threats in some cases. And, you know, frankly, I was afraid the story would never break, especially because behind the scenes there was a set of obstacles for me that made it incredibly fraught over the course of a year of reporting on this. So my feeling emotionally is relief and gratitude to those women.
How much did you share those kinds of concerns about career risks or personal safety risks?
Greatly. You know, it's a tough thing to talk about because I never want to become the story. No reporter does. But, you know, in this case, it is idiosyncratic in that reporters were intimidated and threatened. And, you know, it did mean grappling with the prospect of giving up one's career to go up against this. I'm so grateful to the team at The New Yorker, which came along and really rescued the story and defended me, which had been not the situation I was in for a long time. David Remnick, who runs The New Yorker, is the real deal. He's truly an example of journalistic courage, and they've got an incredible team of editors and fact checkers and copy editors and graphics people that worked around the clock to get this thing out. Because it was urgent, because it was a safety issue for the next woman that was going to come along and be in this situation.
Regarding that urgency, how much clearer are we now on the backstory in terms of the genesis of this while you were at NBC News? The New Yorker was kind of the last stop or the second stop for some of the reporting you did. It began while you were at NBC and didn't advance for reasons that I think are somewhat clear, but not really. How do you reflect on that piece of it?
I think that there will be a time and place to talk more about that down the line, and you're not wrong to ask the question. You know, I would say broadly speaking, I certainly can say the silence surrounding this story for years and years was inextricably coupled with the intimidation and acquiescence of news organizations and systemic problems the media has in bowing to powerful men. And I hope one of the things that people take away from this story is the need for journalistic courage, too, because we owe that to sources like these brave women who spoke in the Weinstein story.
Does that mean that there is a shoe bound to drop at NBC that's connected to this?
I'll leave it at what I just said.
That sounds rather ominous, I gotta say.
I mean, look, I think it certainly should be clear from my reporting so far that I pull no punches. And, you know, when there's documented evidence of corruption, you know, I will not allow myself to be part of silencing that story.
I wonder how your family background played into your reporting on this. You are a Pharaoh, after all, and the stories regarding Mia Farrow and Woody Allen are fairly well documented. How much did that impact your decision to cover this, as well as the way that you engaged with this? Did the fact that you are who you are have any bearing on the way that people talk to you about the sexual harassment they had dealt with in Hollywood?
I think it's important to disentangle two things. You know, Harvey Weinstein and his legal team, which, you know, at the time the signatories on those legal threat letters to me were Charles Harder and Lisa Bloom and David Boies. So, you know, a high-powered team going after me. One of the things that they weaponized was, you know, this very specious argument of, oh, this is a Hollywood kid on a revenge trip. That's not the case. It wasn't the case for the New York Times reporters. It wasn't the case for me. Yes, this was personal in the sense that I had seen the ramifications of sexual assault firsthand because my sister did a really brave thing speaking out against a powerful guy. So I understood the way in which people in power can manipulate the media and intimidate and silence people. And I understood the tremendous compassion and sensitivity that's required if you want to talk to people about what is, for most sexual assault survivors, the worst moment of a lifetime. There was an emotional understanding, but there was not, as Harvey Weinstein tried to claim, any kind of personal vendetta. I had only positive thoughts about Harvey Weinstein, and this was really born of, if anything, you know, me being an ambitious reporter who saw a big story, but also someone with a sense of social justice who saw that this was a safety issue, you know, that this was a pattern, and we had to protect people, to arm them with knowledge. So many women were telling me, I wish I had been warned before I went into that room. And so I couldn't stop because of that. It certainly had nothing to do with any vendetta born of any kind of personal link to Harvey Weinstein. Again, in the personal sense, I only had incentives to feel positive about the guy.
How much did the fact that your last name is Pharaoh affect the way that interviewees interacted with you? Did that open doors or affect the way that they spoke to you?
I don't think it did. I do think the fact that I had publicly spoken in defense of my sister and publicly, you know, really made this issue a significant thread in my reporting career was significant. You know, I had banged my head against the wall trying to carry, when I was a cable news host, the stories of Cosby's accusers at a time when they were receiving a lot of blowback. I did a lot of investigative reporting for my Today Show series on sexual violence on college campuses. And I had spoken frankly about the intimidation and smearing my sister faced and continues to face. And so it is true that in some of my conversations with the accusers of Harvey Weinstein, they said that they felt connected to the fact that I had, you know, put my money where my mouth was, essentially, and talked about this issue and talked about it in a personal way as well.
Adam tweeted, does the language of Me Too need to be reconsidered? Sexual misconduct is a broad term that seems to equate lewd comments with physical acts or coercion. Obviously, all incidents are terrible. I just fear we're glossing over deeds by use of vague language. Ronan, what about that? What about the way we talk about these incidents and the verbiage we use?
I think it's hugely important, Joshua. In the editorial process at The New Yorker, I was profoundly grateful to have voices in the room that stood up for the use of the term rape, which is what these allegations were. We were reporting for the first time multiple allegations of rape. And I think the people who defended that decision, several of whom were women. There was a wonderful fact checker on that first story named Tammy Kim. My wonderful editor, Deirdre Foley Mendelson. They both spoke passionately about the importance of calling it what it is. And, you know, prior to that, among the many obstacles I face, even, you know, before people turned on the story and on me, there was a kind of default supposition, like, just, you can't use the R word in a single draft of any script. It's got to be sexual misconduct. And that's wrong. You know, when there is documented evidence of something that meets the, you know, Justice Department's definition of rape, I think you should call it that. And I think it's a disservice to survivors not to.
Regarding the way that we do talk about these incidents or even allegations of these incidents. Your latest story involved the National Enquirer and its parent company, AMI, paying a New York doorman $30,000 for the exclusive rights to a story about a supposed love child with President Trump, which, by the way, the New Yorker uncovered no evidence to support. But it does get at this larger, this longer kind of tendril of Me Too, which is the effort to kill these stories, catch and kill, this tactic that I think more people are getting acquainted with.
That's right. And that's all deeply connected. It's funny, I was in an off-the-record briefing with a source the other day with a number of reporters from different publications, and one of them said, God, there's not multiple stories, plural. It's all one story, and it's connected. And in a funny way, that's true. You know, Harvey Weinstein was using the National Enquirer to intimidate people and conduct secret calls that he was recording without the permission of women and without the disclosure that the recordings were going back to the Enquirer and to Harvey Weinstein. You know, that was all documented in one of my stories in the fall. These were very similar tools to the ones employed on behalf of the president by David Pecker, the head of the National Enquirer. So there are similar players involved. There are similar abuses of power, and it all contributes to what I hope is an increasing national understanding of the way in which the most powerful and wealthy people in America are still able to distort the media to silence opposition.
For the stories that you've been reporting, you are wading through a lot of very difficult, very contentious, potentially litigious information that has already, you know, brought people basically to their comeuppance for their misdeeds. How do you keep it all straight? As a journalist, how do you know when it's time to pull the trigger on a story or when it's time to walk away?
Well, I'm grateful to say that I have an incredible team around me at The New Yorker, a wonderful general counsel there, Fabio Bertoni. David Remnick has incredible judgment. And, you know, there's a joint judgment, and this is how it should work with journalism, you know, between your editors and you and the lawyer vetting things. And look, you're right about the obstacles. With each investigative story of this level of complication, there's a period of sort of mortal combat as you near publication where, you know, you've been talking to the people involved. The New Yorker famously has one of the most rigorous fact-check processes in the world. And, you know, you don't just slap something online. You're talking for sometimes days and days beforehand with everyone who's mentioned in any minute way. And, you know, you make sure you're dead to rights when you go to people. And then you make sure you're even more dead to rights as you argue with them and hear them out sincerely on any views they have and make sure that the story is as fair as possible in reflecting all those views.
You ever have a moment where in the pit of your stomach you go, oh my God, I hope we're right?
Of course, and that's the correct journalistic instinct to have, and you listen to that voice, and if you have any doubts, even a tiny sliver of doubt, then the piece needs more time, and you don't pull the trigger until that voice goes away. I'm so glad, Joshua, that you're highlighting the importance of fact-checking, if you'll forgive me jumping in there, because it's not something we talk about enough culturally. It's something of a dying art. You know, The New Yorker has this incredible fact-checking process, but more and more, I think one of the costs of the expansion of the media landscape into a lot of new media outlets, which is a wonderful thing in a lot of ways, you know, there's a more democratic media landscape now and more outlets willing to run things that were forbidden once and to chip away at the culture of access journalism at large institutions. But one of the downsides is there aren't robust fact-checking processes at all these places. And, you know, I see that very often when, you know, the intern at whatever blog with the best of intentions puts up an article and there's a whole bunch of things that are wrong in it. And, you know, I see that firsthand when I happen to be mentioned in something and I think, oh, they should have just called, you know. and so I hope everyone hires fact checkers. We need more.
Plenty more to discuss with Ronan Farrow. We'll shift back to talking about the State Department and its future as our conversation with Ronan Farrow continues. Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from the NPR Wine Club. Discover hand-selected wines from award-winning vineyards around the world. Learn the stories behind each one and enjoy unique bottles inspired by your favorite NPR shows, like Weekend Edition, all with the convenience of home delivery. A special welcome offer includes a bottle of Weekend Edition Cabernet Sauvignon. If you're 21 years or older, join in the fun at nprwineclub.org/1A.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk more about diplomacy with two contrasting presidents. Here are two audio clips for you. One of President Trump speaking last year at the Conservative Political Action Conference. But before we hear that, first, here's President Kennedy speaking at his inaugural in 1961.
To those old allies whose cultural and spiritual origins we share, we pledge the loyalty of faithful friends. United, there is little we cannot do in a host of cooperative ventures. Divided, there is little we can do, for we dare not meet a powerful challenge at odds and split asunder.
Global cooperation, dealing with other countries, getting along with other countries is good. It's very important. But there is no such thing as a global anthem, a global currency, or a global flag. This is the United States of America that I'm representing. I'm not representing the globe. I'm representing your country.
That was President Donald Trump speaking at CPAC last year, preceded by President John F. Kennedy's inaugural address in 1961. Ronan Farrow, what do you make of that contrast? Is it just bluster from a blustery president, or is there more to it than that?
The problem is that the bluster is very quickly turning into reality here, Joshua. And I think that the mistake that people make when they buy into the argument that Trump just articulated is this idea that American self-interest is at odds with diplomacy. These alliances are in the interest of the United States. Having a robust set of tools to reach a political settlement, to reach a deal, to use a Trump favorite terminology, is among the most important self-interested priorities the United States can have. And if you look at conflict after conflict that the United States faces, you see that very often political settlements are the only way out and the best hope. It's what Secretary of State after Secretary of State and diplomat after diplomat who worked on North Korea told me, that diplomacy is going to be the only way out. Not necessarily just diplomacy with North Korea, which has to be done in a careful and expertise-driven way, but also diplomacy with China and other regional players.
One of the points you make in the book, though, lest we put this all on the Trump administration, is that the deterioration of the State Department is not just something that started happening in January 2017. This has been happening, as you write about it, for at least the last three administrations. Can you give us one example of what this deterioration has involved over the years, over the administrations before Donald Trump took office?
So you see these headlines about the Trump administration and this sort of war on the State Department, calling it unprecedented. And it is for sure a new extreme, the current purge happening at the State Department. But it isn't without precedent. Actually, there are very clear precedents, as you just suggested, and we can and should learn from them. So one of the most instructive is that Bill Clinton, after the end of the Cold War, came in on this platform of it's the economy, stupid, as James Carville said, and turned the nation very much inward. And one of the consequences of that is that we cut diplomacy and development spending by 30%. And it's very easy to look at what happened then. We surrendered a ton of influence in a lot of important places, places that were reshaping after the fall of the Soviet Union. We closed two government agencies that are related to what happened to be two of our biggest priorities now, information and arms control. And we ended up in a situation where on 9/11, the State Department was really quite disempowered and crippled. And that was one of the reasons why, you know, among many other reasons, we began doing a lot of the work of diplomacy and development out of the Pentagon rather than through the State Department in the years after 9/11. And one of the interesting things you see, Joshua, is that late in the Clinton administration, late in the Bush administration, and late in the Obama administration, there was course correction. There was a realization each time for different reasons, oh, we actually need diplomacy. And I talk about that shift in each of those cases. But it's very often too little too late. And now, you know, we see no evidence of course correction so far in this administration. They seem to be really doubling down on just getting rid of our diplomats.
It sounds like part of what you're saying is that each presidential administration keeps making the same mistake, in your view, over and over again. They correct too far over to the military, then they go, diplomats, diplomats, and then they kind of come a little bit further back, and then the next administration does it over and over again.
I think there's a fair argument for that.
We did a program about the state of the State Department back in December before Rex Tillerson was let go as Secretary of State. And one of the people we spoke to is one of the people you quote quite a bit in the book, Thomas Countryman, a former diplomat. He said there are, and we want to play a little piece of this, he said there are four factors contributing to what he called the systematic destruction of the Foreign Service.
At the personal level, the management actions taken by Secretary Tillerson are pushing out the most experienced people in the Foreign Service. At the institutional level, by slashing the budget, greatly reducing the intake of new officers, he's weakening the Foreign Service over the next several years. At the national level, we have a White House that constantly disparages and distrusts not only the professional diplomats who have served Republicans and Democrats with equal loyalty over the years. And at the global level, what we see is a president who is weakening American standing in the world, retreating from American leadership, embracing dictators, and undermining our alliances.
Ronan, you bookend the book with the story of Thomas Countryman, who spent about 35 years in the Foreign Service, and then talk about his rather unceremonious firing. How representative is his story and his point of view about the State Department and what's going on there?
I love that you played that clip because Thomas Countryman's voice is one of the pleasures of the reporting process that went into this book. I think I describe him as sounding like a text-to-speech application or a Bond villain. you know, he's American, but he's served in so many different places for so long that he has like 100 different accents in one. You know, he's a great example of, honestly, I don't use the term lightly, but a patriotic public servant. He, you know, he cares deeply about his country. He spent decades developing expertise in this very specific area of arms control. And, you know, his story is instructive because at a time when, you know, nuclear disarmament needs to be one of our most important priorities, when we're facing down, you know, the fragile Iran deal and decisions about what to do about it and the threat of North Korea, we need more focus on that area. And yet Tom Countryman, our most senior arms control official at the State Department, was, as you said, unceremoniously fired within the first few days of the Trump administration. So, yes, I think that it is representative. He was one of many, many people who got some variant of a pink slip or a removal from their post during that period. It was called by a few of the diplomats I talked to the Mahogany Row Massacre. Mahogany Row is the kind of corridor of power in the State Department, and a lot of people got calls all at once in a period of several weeks saying, you know, we're getting rid of you. And for Tom Countryman, you know, I know that that was personally painful, although he's careful to say this was no sob story for me, this isn't about me. But more than that, it's representative of a real callous disregard for expertise.
Let me get to a few more listener questions before our time with you is up. Michael emailed, "The state of the State Department post this presidency, or worse, post a second term of the same, will leave nothing of a time when it worked. What does the road back look like? Is it simply having the right leadership, or is there much more?"
Well, you know, one of the reasons why I thought this book was worth writing is that it's not simply documentation of a problem. It gives a clear view of feasible solutions. It's not too late. You know, you look at the precedent of what happened during and after World War II, and you see a similar outdated, dysfunctional State Department, and then a real push for reform that was quite successful. And I think it's not unrealistic to think that we could do the same now. If you have leadership that sincerely cares about diplomatic endeavor and is willing to empower and not micromanage diplomats, and sees that as, you know, a frontline tool in addressing the conflicts that we face around the world, and puts its money where its mouth is. You know, you need to have an administration willing to resource the State Department. Again, not just throwing money at the current bureaucracy, which has many, many flaws and needs reform, but fixing it, overhauling it, modernizing it. It can be done.
Wish we had more time to continue this conversation. Ronan Farrow, author of War on Peace, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Joshua.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.